Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound, and Tom Edwards.
On the show today, the Book of Seconds. Writer Mark Mason will be telling us about notorious feats and statistics that haven't quite made first place in the history books. His own new volume is looking to put that right. Later in the show, we'll also be talking with writer and war reporter Ed Villiamy. He'll be discussing his book When Words Fail, which looks at how music can accentuate a lifetime and some of the dramatic situations found within. And we'll be hearing from pioneering French filmmaker Agnès Varda, who, along with street artist JR, has created one of the best documentaries of recent years, Faces Places, a portrait of the French nation through art and photography.
That's all coming up, plus Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be bringing us some of next week's news, and we'll have some great music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Hi, Tom.
Rob, good afternoon.
Welcome to the programme, one and all. Now, it's nice, isn't it, when we tackle the introductory notes of this programme. Amazing people.
Legendary also.
Mark Mason, I'm very much looking forward to speaking to him.
He's an
amusing character.
Can we say it's a parade of legends?
It's an embarrassment of riches.
And can we wheel out another iconic figure to get the ball rolling?
Yeah, let's do it. There was something. And here he comes, in a puff of smoke, wearing a cape. And now, let's go for it. Next week's news.
Let's go for it. Let's start with Swaziland, or a country formerly known as Swaziland, because, you know, since April, they're known now as the Kingdom of Eswatini. And actually, they are voting their general election this Friday as well, the 21st of September. But it's a very unusual, they have an unusual way of doing politics. Of course, you know, the King Mswati III, I mean, he's the main ruler, the last monarch in sub-Saharan Africa. But still, there's still 59 sub-regions in the country. Country that they elect like kind of a representative of this region. Political parties are not allowed. So every single one of those 59 people that will be potentially elected, they're independent as well. And then there's an extra 10 that are chosen, you know, by the king. So it's quite an unusual. And then shall we move on to something, you know, a bit lighter? It's the Emmy Awards on Monday. And the reason why I chose the Emmys, I have to say, I mean, I am a big fan of the Oscars. I've always been. And I always think of the Emmys as kind of the poor cousin of the Oscars. But I think things are changing, you know.
The power of telly.
In the last decade, I mean, there's been amazing series, you know. You have, you know, Netflix, new streaming services, including Disney upcoming. And there's quite a lot of good ones. I don't know which series you guys follow, but apparently The Handmaid's Tale might win again, you know, the main awards. They were the biggest
winners.
Will
a question of sport be up for anything?
So, yeah.
I'm joking, of course.
Blank look from Fernando.
Sorry.
Yeah, I was like, what? I actually did see once A Question of Sport, but yeah, I couldn't get
it. Reminds me of that famous joke in The Thick of It where, like, that is not funny. That's less funny than A Question of Sport.
There's few absolutes, but that's something one of you can be sure of.
Yeah.
But Game of Thrones, again, the highest number of nominations, 22 nominations for that series, and 21 for Westworld, which, I've got to be honest, never seen this one as well.
I haven't seen that. I'd like to.
I watched that.
It's one of my favourite films, the original film.
It's
Michael Crichton directed that one himself.
He did.
I think, as well.
It's not anywhere near as good. But I watched the first season. It was
such a good idea that you can kind of
okay.
get into it.
Yeah. And it had the effects were rather more lavish than in the charming but slightly dated looking.
I kind of don't mind that
original.
Though, a little bit of sort of.
And one in the best limited series category, which I think, Tom, you've seen some episodes. We discussed about the assassination of Gianni Versace. Again, one of the favorites to win. And again, I have mixed opinions. I had high expectations. I don't think it's terrible, but, you know.
Yeah, I was disappointed because this is from the same stable that brought us the O.J. Simpson sort of part dramatization. And I arrived with a great deal of enthusiasm. And I must admit, I abandoned it after a couple of installments.
I did as well, actually. I think the screenplay was written by Tom Rob Smith, who's a very fine novelist and has been in here a couple of times, and he's really brilliant. And I kind of wanted to like it more than I sort of ended up doing.
I tried to love it.
Me.
Yeah.
But
I think that
scene where they play Easy Lover in an S&M scene, that was quite amazing.
Yeah.
Just that scene, they deserve quite a
memorable,
few Emmys.
Memorable.
Very I want memorable. Fernando to give out his own awards for specific bits.
I love specific
series.
Bits.
Yeah, exactly.
Again, if you like your beer and your wurst, it's the Oktoberfest as well, which, again, if you're an expert, you should know that it doesn't start in October. It starts in September. And the main reason, actually, I was looking, I thought it would be like a clever... Well, it's because of the weather. It's just because September is better than October. And it's sunnier and people are outside having, you know...
If they changed it to make it more sort of temperate.
Yeah, I think it's been kind of a recent change. Okay. I mean, the Oktoberfest has been pretty old since the 185th one. Yeah. And the main reason is because, you know, the Bavarian prince, he married a princess back in 1810, and it was a month of celebration, which was October.
That was the thing.
And everybody was just very happy.
It was when they picked the hops or something like that.
That was because of a wedding, the prince wedding.
And on the print side of things, Monica, they're doing a special Bavarian newspaper to sort of tie in with Oktoberfest because it's a thing that's worth celebrating. It's a big Bavarian, you know, lash up and all the rest of it. That's all good stuff. But also it's a time when there's a lot of trade is done. A lot of business is done at Oktoberfest. It's a bit like entertaining people, taking them to Goodwood or the Test Match or Wembley or something. A lot of people get taken to Oktoberfest by their merchant bank or their whatever it is or their insurance company and entertained at Oktoberfest. And so everyone has to go and they have to get fitted for their lederhosen. So a friend of mine who works for Swiss bank and lives in Geneva is going to write us a column about what it's like to have to try to do business on about 20 pints.
Well, like, this is where I wanted to go.
He's very amazing. He's a Frenchman who lives in Switzerland and works for Swiss bank, but had to be measured for his lederhosen in order to go to Munich and do a pitch and a presentation and the rest of it. It should be a fairly decent read. So anyway, that's my little plug for the Bavarian special newspaper that we're doing.
I wonder how many, and if ever, has been a huge deal done that none of the parties that did the deal can remember about.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Just sort of cutting room floor.
A pallet of something turns up at some warehouse in Stuttgart. And everyone's going, where did this come from? Oh, that was from the Oktoberfest. Oh, yeah, exactly. Fernando, thank you as ever for next week's news.
In a moment, we'll be talking to Mark Mason. Don't go anywhere.
For every winner, there's a loser, but you might be kinder to call these runners-up, or the ones who tried pretty hard and gave things a really good go. So why don't we ever hear their stories, sometimes equally, if not more colourful and dramatic, than the famous ones who made it to the hallowed centre ground of the podium.
Writer Mark Mason has been considering this in his new book, The Book of Seconds, the incredible stories of the ones that didn't quite win. And he joins us now to talk about it. Mark, welcome back to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you very much, Tom.
A frequent visitor. Is it the idea of glorious failure, the nearly there? Is that what adds this particular allure
that
you're
writing about? It's glorious, but it's not failure. I mean, these people, mostly it's people, there's a few objects in there, like K2, second tallest mountain and things like that, but mostly it's people, and they didn't fail, they were just quite unlucky. John Landy is really, really unlucky. He was the second man to run a 4-minute mile, and he managed to do it, it was something like 3 weeks after Roger Bannister. It was one where they were both really knocking up against the four-minute mark, and he just happened to come second by 3 weeks. In fact, he set a time that was the world record for about 3 years. Bannister just about did it, 3:59 point something. John Landy went 3:57 point something, which, you know, 2 seconds in that sort of field is a massive difference. And yet no one's ever heard of him. It's completely unfair. And he was a fantastic bloke. He was a couple of years after that, that was 54, 1956, he was in the Olympic 1500-metre final, and somebody fell over, and he stopped to check on the guy who'd fallen over, then still managed to catch up and win the gold medal. I mean, if he was that sort of guy and he was the first guy to run the 4-minute mile, what a hero. You've never heard of him.
There's almost something about it of they're the thinking man's winners, right? Because some of the stories are so rarefied and almost too perfect that this is a more nourishing book than the Guinness Book of World Records or the Book of Firsts, right? I mean, there is something about that.
I would certainly, I think the thinking man thing, says he, trying to make himself sound like a thinking man. You've set me up for a massive falling rule. Apollo 12, I think, is the ultimate one because nobody has ever heard of Pete Conrad or Alan Bean. And they were only the third and fourth men to walk on the moon.
Yeah.
Neil Armstrong, I don't know if he was an interesting guy, actually. I mean, I'm an Apollo nut, so I know quite a bit about him. I feel quite safe when I say he wasn't that interesting a guy. Buzz Aldrin, famous now for his plastic surgery, as he is for walking on the moon. Pete Conrad and Alan Bean, two really, really interesting guys, particularly because... This sort of goes back a bit to the failure thing. In Alan Bean's case, I was lucky enough to interview him a few years ago, and he admitted himself he was never the most naturally talented astronaut or pilot. They were all military pilots that then became astronauts. And he said, I always just worked. He said, you ask yourself, what is it that's going to let you succeed? And you're praying that the one thing that it isn't is talent. Because if it's talent, then it's just preordained. There's nothing you can do. He said, I used to work really hard. In the run-up to Apollo 12, the mission, when he was introduced to someone at a party, he would deliberately forget their name as soon as he was given their name because he didn't want that information crowding out something important in his memory that he was going to need on the mission. And then when he got to the moon, they all got, all the moonwalkers and all the Apollo astronauts, even the ones who stayed in the capsule and didn't walk on the moon, got gold NASA badges. Up until that point, you only got a silver one. When Alan Bean was standing on the moon, he left his silver one in the moon dust on the moon because he knew that when he got back to Earth, he was going to get the gold one. They were really, really interesting guys. You never get to hear their stories.
There is something, I guess, also about the man who ran the second four-minute mile after Roger Bannister, whose name, John Landy.
Yep.
John Landy, phew, because I thought that. It's one of the other things I share in common with Alan Bean is just purposefully losing information as soon as I picked it up.
You're about to go onto a moon mission.
Yeah, exactly. This is what's happening. But are you finding that a lot of these people, places, things are the one that sort of opened the floodgates, that after them it was normal to be a million-pound footballer or a four-minute-mile athlete, etc. Is this what happens?
And the million-pound footballer, Trevor Francis, famously the first million-pound football transfer in this country. Second guy was Steve Daly, who went from, I forget which club, to Man City a few months later. And it was a complete failure. He really was a failure. It was just a nightmare move because there was too much pressure put on him. It happened too early in his career. And his own website now bills him as the world's first 1,437,500 footballer. But then also let's not go on about the failures because the whole point of the book is that these people are massive successes, deeply interesting. And let's take one of the non-human ones, K2 I mentioned, second tallest mountain. That has killed proportionately way more people than Everest. You ask mountaineers, they'll say it's a far more difficult climb. It's a really, really intimidating climb. And adding to that intimidating air is the fact that the reason it's called K2 is that when the Brits were in that part of the world in the 19th century, mapping everywhere out and doing surveys, that range of mountains has a name that begins with K. I think it's Karakoram, that's it. And so the two tallest peaks were nicknamed K1 and K2. They very quickly realised that K1 had a local name, Mashabrum, which is what it's known as today. K2 is so remote and so intimidating, you can't even see it from the nearest village. So it never had a local name. The Brits were the first people ever to call it anything. And it's K2. And it's now still, it's about 3,000 people have climbed Everest now. 300 people have climbed K2 because it's just that difficult.
Once again, you're exhibiting the fact that there's so much great anecdote and story attached to these. Well, I don't know. In terms of the great history of the world, maybe the also-rans.
Yeah.
But what's the, other than some of the wonderful stories that you've got and you're going to continue to give us, Mark, about this stuff, is the idea of firstness. There is a sort of interesting philosophical idea that you must have weighed up when you're writing this book about what's the point. I mean, firstness is kind of interesting. It's the newsflash, but the nourishing stuff is how that filters into the culture, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's complete chance as well. That's the other thing. And a lot of the time it's complete chance. Like I say, with Landy and Bannister, they were both pretty much as good as each other, you know, and it's just which one happens to get there first. And I think it's getting worse and worse, actually, that attention spans in these days of, I hate to use the phrase social media because it gets blamed for everything these days, but I think attention spans is once something's happened, you just turn away from it, you know. Apollo 12, they didn't help themselves talking about the technology of it because Alan Bean, God bless him, and like I say, I worship the man. I feel very guilty because I've killed him, by the way. He died about 3 months ago, just after we finished the book. I'm killing my heroes. One of the first things he did when he unpacked the camera, the movie camera, or the moving picture camera from the equipment when they landed on the moon, because Apollo 11, all the footage was in black and white. When you think back to it, Neil's first step and everything, black and white. They were going to use a colour camera on Apollo 12. First thing Alan Bean did was accidentally point it straight at the sun and burn out the lens. So he did slightly hinder his own case there, and that's why there's no moving footage of Apollo 12. But I'm also intrigued by the ones that do stay sort of deliberately below the radar. And that exact phrase, below the radar, is what Brian Johnson uses about AC/DC, who have got the second best-selling album ever. You ask anyone the best-selling album ever, they're all going to know it's Michael Jackson, Thriller. Brilliant album, 65 million copies, you can't argue with that. You ask everyone else, people about those same people that know that, you ask them about the second best-selling album. Hardly anyone's going to say Back in Black. No. It sold 50 million copies. And there are beautiful little stories about it. Brian Johnson, like I say, just part of his wearing the cap is that he doesn't get recognised. Yeah. You know? And they're just happy to have sold tens of millions of albums. And of course, as soon as that sold tens of millions, then everyone went back and bought Highway to Hell, the one before that. So that's now up, well up there in the charts. But the bell at the beginning of Back in Black on Hell's Bells, the first song, it's just a bong, bong. They tried to record. They liked the sound. I love the fact that it's in Loughborough. of all the non-rock and roll places. It's a war memorial tower in Loughborough that has got this bell in it called the Denison Bell for some reason. And they liked the sound of it. And they tried to record it. But every time they tried to record it, because by definition, you've got to wait for the bell to go off, at which point all the pigeons that are on the tower fly off, blah, 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 ruin the recording. So what did they do? It was a rock and roll band in 1980. They had their own bell made.
So good.
At the same foundry that made Great Paul, the biggest bell in Britain, which is in St. Paul's now. They had a bell, which made about a ton, this bell. Not massive by St. Paul's standards, but big enough to make a nice sound in a recording studio. Then they start using it on tour. And they took it out on tour for about 3 or 4 years until one night it came off its rope and nearly killed Angus Young, at which point they stopped using it. So there's all these little stories that, you know, you hear a million stories about Thriller.
That is
you
so
never
good.
Hear the stories about Back in Black.
And there's something there, I mean, Rob alluded to this right at the beginning, Mark, about it's kind of the connoisseur's choice, isn't it? I guess there's still a demographic, though, for whom, you know, the fact that something is the number one, the most popular, renders it less appealing. Yeah. And, you know, I'm sure there's many more people who would confess to be fans of AC/DC than Michael Jackson. Would there be? I don't know, on the basis that
they're one of those cult bands.
They're just, I think, they're kind of better.
They always remind me of Randy Newman. I mean, musically very different. But, I mean, I worship both AC/DC and Randy Newman. As soon as you find someone else that, like, you just end up in a three-act conversation about them.
Watch out, Randy, though.
Sorry, yeah. I deliberately haven't put him any books.
he's still doing a lot of great work.
But the other thing is, it becomes self-perpetuating, because once something is talked about all the time, it gets talked about all the time. That's why you always... Yeah. If you hear a reference about a US president being assassinated, if you're going to make a joke about it in a sitcom or in The Simpsons or something like that, you're going to make either the JFK reference or the Abraham Lincoln reference. You're not going to make the reference of James Garfield, who was the second US president to be assassinated. Yeah. And again, fascinating character. He was so intellectual. He could write simultaneously with the right and left hand. The right hand he wrote in Greek, the left hand he wrote in Latin, and he could do that simultaneously. Now, if Abraham Lincoln had been able to do that, we'd all know it.
You
know?
Yeah.
And then also, the James Garfield story is utterly bizarre. How this is not one of the best-known stories, I don't know, because he gets shot by this guy who was slightly unhinged and was convinced that he'd played a part in Garfield's election and wasn't being given due credit, so he married. And he went and bought a gun to shoot Garfield with, and deliberately chose one with a nice handle so that it would look good in a museum when it became... when it became famous as the gun that had shot the president. So then he goes to the station, the train station where Garfield regularly got this train from, and was going there one day to shoot him, but Garfield's wife was with him and he felt sorry. He didn't want to shoot the bloke in front of his wife, so he put it off. Then he came back and did it. Didn't manage to do a clean job. Garfield hangs on for months. I mean, about 3 or 4 months. And there's a bullet lodged somewhere in the body, which the doctors are probing for with unsterilized fingers, which so infection, which even in 1881, which is when this happening, is still, you know you shouldn't be doing it. And then who turns up in the story? Alexander Graham Bell, who specifically for this case has invented a metal detector, which he's going to use to try and find the bullet in Garfield's body. But the metal bed frame that Garfield's his bed had a metal frame, that interferes with the operation of it. And also the doctors were convinced it was on the wrong, whichever side of the body it was on, they were convinced it was on the other. They wouldn't let Alexander Graham Bell use the metal detector on the correct side of the body. And Bell maintained to his dying day, he said, if I'd been allowed to search in the right part of the body, I would have found the bullet. How is that story not more well known?
Is that good?
It's extraordinary. And I wonder, and I know this is a stupid question in a sense, because, you know, got an excellent book, you know, wanting to make it a compelling case for people to get hold of a copy. But
all good bookshops.
Are there some of these stories where you almost don't... It's a bit like we talked before on in this studios about pub quiz questions and all the rest of it. Are there things you almost don't want to give away precisely because they're so brilliant that you almost want to protect them and not have them be the story that everyone tells?
I've got a friend who's very much... He writes similar books to me, Marcus Berkman, who writes lots of trivia books and quiz books and things. And he is a hoarder. He keeps things for quizzes. Now, I have to be very careful with him because I now set the quiz regularly at the same pub that he goes to. So once in a while, I find myself with him or someone else that I know is going to be at the quiz of trying to keep it back. But when it comes to the books, no, I love them. The stuff about the second Oscar ceremony I found out for the book. The guy who won was Cedric Gibbons. He won Best Art Direction at the second Oscar ceremony in 1930. Coincidentally, he was the guy that designed the Oscar itself.
And then he
ended up winning loads of them. And so I was looking into the Oscar statuette itself to put some details in about the book. It was based on a Mexican actor called Emilio Fernandez, who had to be persuaded to pose nude because the figure is nude on the statue. It's 13 and a half inches tall, weighs 8.5 pounds, and it's standing, the Oscar, the figure, is standing on a reel of film which has five spokes to symbolise the five branches of the cinematic arts that the Oscars represent. So once you start looking into something like this, it veers off into lots of other areas. And so the research for this was a joy.
Yeah, this is an amazing thing. There is the fact that we know who the winners are, as it were, the people that did something first or whatever. But are the stories, because these stories are amazing, they're really good and they're well-told anecdotes, Mark, but is there maybe the sense also that we simply don't know them and that we're actually learning something new? There's the satisfaction of learning something new rather than going, oh, we all know about Thriller, we all know about Roger Bannister, etc. There's that thrill of a bit like a really well-set quiz question of being able to sort of make an educated guess, perhaps, but when you actually know the answer, it kind of floors you, right?
Yeah, and a lot of them are fairly insubstantial and, you know, AC/DC and their bells and the Oscar and nude actors and all that sort of stuff. But once in a while, you came across one that you think, hang on, this really should be better known. Peter Norman. Do you know who Peter Norman was? I'll tell you, he's an athlete.
Is he the guy who suggested that Black Power guys wear one glove on each hand?
He's good. 2 points.
That's very good.
Two points to Tom. He's ahead in the quiz. Rob, come on, you've got to catch up here. Yeah, 1968, 200 metres final at the Olympics.
Right.
The Black Power, Tommy Smith and John Carlos were the two black American runners who famously did the Black Power salute. And again, Peter Norman is a really, really important figure because he was the white Australian runner who came second. Now, understandably, he doesn't quite fit into the two guys giving the salute, and he didn't give the salute himself, but on the way out to the podium, he heard what they were going to do, and he said, "Oh, come on, let's do something." And he borrowed a little badge that someone else was wearing, and he wore that for the ceremony. And he ended up suffering for the rest of his career, because back in Australia, there were lots of guys that weren't happy that he'd shown solidarity with these two black American runners. But yet, one of them forgot his gloves. and so they said, "Oh, no." So Peter Norman says, "Well, why don't you just use the one pair you've got and use one glove each?"
Yeah.
So one of them is lifting up right fist in the Black Power salute. The other one's lifting up the left fist in the black, which no one ever notices. This guy, Peter Norman, brilliant runner, because that was Mexico, the Mexico Games, which was set at altitude. All those times were really good in all the events. I think the long jump record still stands, doesn't it?
It stood until Mike Powell broke it with 8.95, but Bob Beamon set 8.80 there.
Yeah.
Which lasted until the 1990s.
Yeah. And Peter Norman's 200 metres time in that final, I think, is still the Australian record or something like that. He was just incredible. He got all this flack. He died a few years ago. Both the other two runners went to his funeral. They flew across from the States to Australia to go to his funeral because they appreciate... They said he didn't raise the fist, but he sure helped a hand, which I thought
was
a nice little quote.
Good. That's really interesting. On the note of, you know, it's a long jump record still standing in Australia or whatever it might be, did you find that the people that came second that did this, that and the other second... We mentioned, you know, the 4 minute mile stuff was eclipsed or was equaled very soon after Roger Bannister. But did you find that some of them, a bit like that Australian long jump record or something? Actually, it was 3 years ago that something was beaten for the first time, or the second took a long time after the first, or were most of them right in the footsteps?
That's really intriguing. Like the big contrast is between John Landy, like I say, 3 weeks after Roger Bannister, second guy to swim the Channel. First guy was Captain Matthew Webb, 1875. I can tell Tom knows that.
I was going to chip in, but I
I would have got those 2 points, Tom's guy. Yeah. So he'd have been 4 points ahead of you, Nero. 1875, Captain Matthew Webb swims the Channel. It's 36 years before someone does it for the second time. 80 attempts in those 36 years for someone to do it again. Got to the point that in 1911, when it finally did happen, someone managed to swim it for the second time, the widow of Captain Matthew Webb said, I'm so glad someone has done it a second time, because all this time, 36 years, no one or a lot of people had refused to believe that her husband had done it for real.
Right.
And there were lots of suspicions that he cheated or he'd been aided. But Bill Burgess, a guy from Rotherham.
Loughborough, Rotherham.
He does it. And Captain Matthew Webb, the first guy, hadn't worn goggles. Bill Burgess wears goggles. He wears motorcycle goggles, which leak and start letting him water and it hurts his eyes. And he allowed himself, and I love this, 20 drops of champagne per hour, quote, and not a drop more during his during his attempt. It's like Michael Palin ripping yarns.
Yeah.
You know, if someone is swimming the channel, 20 drops of champagne an hour, my man.
Yeah.
You can imagine the guy in the boat with the pipette just handing it out to him. You know?
Imagine that man's job as well. It's so good. It's so rich, isn't it? But before we go, we should... Where is this kind of mythic pub quiz? Are we allowed to tell people?
Oh, it's not mythic at all. If you find yourself in Highgate in North London on a Tuesday night, Prince of Wales... And it's a fantastic pub quiz, and it's become quite famous because Marcus has done books of questions about it, and Marcus did quizzes in newspapers, and it always gets a mention. And whenever any of the broadsheets do a piece about pub quizzes, the Prince of Wales in Highgate gets a mention. And people know that I go to it, and they go, "Is it really, really difficult?" And I go, "No. The joy is that a really good quiz question shouldn't be difficult. It's not." The really worst sort of pub quizzes are, you know, what's the capital of so-and-so? And it's somewhere you've never heard of and you're never going to work it out. Whereas a good quiz question are things like this that you can work out. You know, you put in some cryptic reference to which item of equipment from Back in Black or something, and then there'll be someone on the team who knows the album. They go, oh, it's not one of the instruments, it's the bell. You know, that's what a well-constructed quiz question should be about. So if anyone wants any more of this deeply intellectual trivia...
It's good stuff, isn't it?
Either a Tuesday night at Prince of Wales in Highgate, or for the many, many percentage, the big, big percentage of listeners who won't be able to get there. On Twitter, I'm at WalkTheLinesLDN. Come on, my previous books was about London. At WalkTheLinesLDN, or the website is theimportanceofbeingtrivial.com.
It's good stuff, isn't it? What a shame. I mean, it's a wonderful book, Tom, The Book of Seconds. Shame, obviously, that Mark, living up to the title of the book, he's obviously the second person to write such a great book. Imagine if that were true. I'm only joking, of course.
But I was going to say, I refuse to purchase this until it's the second edition.
Yeah.
And I imagine the joke has been done a million times, but...
Boom.
Second edition. We should have done a first edition of one, so that the second edition was a
Damn it. You and your editor, who we weren't going to mention...
Alan Sampson. If you want a man on your pub quiz team, Alan Sampson is... in fact, Marcus, he was Marcus's editor years before... Marcus knew him years before I knew him. When I started doing books with Alan, I said, oh, Alan Sampson's my editor. And I knew about Alan. And Marcus emailed me back. He said, he's hardcore. He said he's forgotten stuff that the rest of us will never know. It's just, he really knows stuff, Alan.
It's good stuff. Mark Mason is the author of The Book of Seconds, the incredible stories of the ones that didn't quite win. Thank you so much.
Robert Bound, time for some music.
Yes, please.
This is from Michigan's Fred Thomas. It's Alters. Some catchy guitar pop there from Fred Thomas. The track was Alter. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. Ed Villiamy's decades as a journalist covering events ranging from the Bosnian War to 9/11 and Iraq for outlets such as The Guardian and Observer have won him the International Reporter of the Year award twice. But his latest book, When Words Fail, looks at music and how it's helped shape not only his own life, but also his perception of some of those very dramatic events he's been a witness to. Earlier, he spoke to Monocle's Andrew Muller.
I wanted to start with the obvious place, which is the title. Has it been a recurrent frustration to you that there are times that music can seem to articulate what any reporter's words never quite can?
Well, it's a good question, and it's the right one. There is the specific answer, which is that Yeah, it's one of Samuel Beckett's many great lines. You know, what shall we do when even words fail? And he was arguably the best, if not one of the best writers of the 20th century. I think anyone who tries to write seriously will have to find or come up against the limitations of words. If they don't, they're not writing seriously. And there will be things that happen, like the opening of the book and the Haydn trio in
this
Sarajevo.
The setting in Sarajevo.
In Sarajevo, yeah. When sort of whatever I write about the siege of Sarajevo cannot convey the mood of what it feels like to be a human being under siege in a European capital city for 3 years. Having your concert of Haydn's trio interrupted by a shell that comes so close to the building the viola player's music stand falls over, everybody doesn't know what to do. And then he picks up the stand and the first violinist calls the number of the interrupted bar and they play on. I mean, I can tell that story, but I cannot convey what it felt like to hear the Haydn, the elegance and melancholy and effervescence of Haydn's quartet under shellfire, only being there and only that the music could do that. But your question raises another very important issue, which is recurrent in the book. You know, by a mixture of sort of luck and determination, it contains the last interview B.B. King gave before he died. And he, as the master of his art, I mean, the maestrissimo of his art, the greatest of them all, said something very important. He said, "The night I say I was good, that's when I gotta stop, because it's never good enough." Everybody wanna know. So it's not just writers who come up against the limitations of words. If you are a great musician rather than a good musician, you come up against the limitations of music. George Scholte, it's not actually in the book, but Sir George Scholte, I heard from his widow Valerie, was always, you know, inundated with fawning people at the end of another sort of heart-stopping performance of a Mahler symphony. And he would say, no, there was a problem with the adagio. And, you know, this is, I mean, I sometimes think that one of the problems with our current state of literature in this country is that, you know, there are lots of people who just think they're good. And that's a terrible mistake. It's never good enough, and the words will never be enough. Sometimes you have to give up on them and resort to music, and that's really what the book is about.
I was struck by your recollection of meeting B.B. King for his last ever interview, because B.B. King, weirdly, I think was about the third interview I ever did when I was a teenage idiot writing for a street paper in Sydney. And I was struck at the time by how incredibly humble he was and how utterly, I guess, uncomplacent about his place in the firmament he was. And it has been my general experience interviewing many musicians since that the actual proper people, the actual living legends, tend to be extremely humble and extremely self-effacing, where it's the chancers, the opportunists and frauds who have the rock star arrogance about them.
A very good observation. I mean, there's a short section on Robert Plant. One of the details there isn't room for in the book is we were in Canada and it was minus 20 walking down the road in Toronto, and a fan stops him walking his dog and asks Plant for his autograph. Plant not only signs the piece of paper, but he sort of engages this man in a long conversation about his dog and how much he misses his own back in the Welsh border country. Yes, I mean, you know, you get to a point like B.B. King when you really, you know, you don't have to fall back on any ego because your mastery of the art is doing it for you.
Did you find, or have you found, I guess, as your career as a foreign correspondent and especially a war reporter progressed, did you find yourself regarding music as a way of, I guess, articulating the feelings you had about that to yourself, or as a solace from it? Because the book's also, it's kind of a memoir refracted through your relationship with music and trying to figure out what it has meant to you and why.
Yes, absolutely. And thank you. It is a sort of memoir through music and through the people who play music. It was actually the idea, I mean, my original idea for the book was greeted by the editor at Granter, Max Porter, as a wonderful mess. Now, I don't know, it's probably slightly, I hope, less of a mess now, but he had this brilliant idea of don't write a memoir and don't just write about music. Choose specific concerts you went to. Not necessarily the best, just ones that are important for the reasons you were there, for the reasons the musicians were there and for the reasons that the audience were there. And so, you know, we open each chapter with the description of the performance, page and a half or so, and then it's why were we all there and what is happening? There's a bit at the beginning where Graham Nash is sitting behind the Beatles at a Jimi Hendrix concert in London in the mid-60s, and he says, what on earth is going on? It's a very good question. What indeed, it needs an answer. I'm not saying the book finds an answer, but it's a good question and an important one. What is going on? And that's really what I try to do. Your question about solace and expression is crucial, really, because that's what, you know, Beckett's questions tend not to have answers. That's the whole point of Samuel Beckett. That's why he's so wonderful. What shall we do when words fail? God knows. But anyway, let's try music and see what happens. And yeah, absolutely. The first war I really sort of covered was Ireland. But the first time I ever found myself under shell fire, watching refugees fleeing along roads that had been reduced to rubble, was in Vukovar in Croatia, in what was, with hindsight, the sort of the overture to the carnage in Bosnia. And we took a break behind the front lines at a place called Nazice, which was not being shelled. And Robert Fox, a much more seasoned war reporter than
We know Robert very well. He's a regular.
He's a good man. And he could see I was in a bad shape. And I had tried to use the words that I had in my head. Now, this was before I habitually take a thesaurus with me everywhere I go, which I do. But even that runs out in the end. And he said, look, Ed, don't sit chin-wagging with us in the bar. Go upstairs. And he gave me a Sony Walkman and a tape. He said, try this, if in doubt, Beethoven. And I took this Sony Walkman upstairs, put in the cassette. It was the Seventh Symphony. And within 5 minutes, I'd burst into tears. Beethoven was sort of doing something that I could never do, to describe Vukovar, if you like. And this went on. I mean, there's a bit where one war I did not go to that came to me was 9/11, when I was trying to live La Dolce Vita in New York, having failed to do so in Italy, because I ended up in Bosnia when I was in Italy. And there was a period between the attacks by Al-Qaeda that September morning, 20 blocks from where I was living. Well, there was Afghanistan, then Iraq. And I did not go to New York thinking I would end up back in Iraq, where I'd already been in 1991. But I did, because that's what history seems to do to me. And there was a song by Patti Smith called Waiting Underground that sort of epitomized that. She played it at one of her New Year's Eve concerts. And it was the sound of the song, the sound of her voice, got that mood of impasse, of impending disaster, of sort of plodding towards this horror show so inevitably day to day in the news that nothing we could write could do.
Experiences like that and the one you mentioned with Beethoven's Seventh in Vukovar made you more or less indulgent of musicians who try to articulate themselves the experience of war or their feelings about war, few of whom, of course, have any direct experience of it.
Yes, absolutely. Well, the first full chapter of the book is hearing Jimi Hendrix play Machine Gun at the Isle of Wight, 18 days before he died, in the street on which I was born, incidentally, in Notting Hill. He played that song. And it was, of course, the anthem of my generation with regard to the war in Vietnam. It is a searing cry against war. It musically describes war. And it is, as it were, a cry for peace depicted in the sound of warfare on a guitar. Hendrix had never been, he'd been in the army.
He was a ranger, wasn't he?
Indeed, and the writer Paul Gilroy, in his book Darker Than Blue, thinks it's terribly important that we must see Hendrix as a former soldier who turned his back on militarism and the military. But Hendrix had never been to war. And, you know, a lot of, to my knowledge, Patti Smith went on to write Radio Baghdad. To my knowledge, she's never been to Iraq or in a conflict zone. But there is a chapter on Sarajevo, inevitably, later in the book, where we talk about the people who did go and play under siege at great risk to themselves. And at that superstar level, it counts three names: Susan Sontag, who went to direct Waiting for Godot, and Joan Byers and Bruce Dickinson of Iron Maiden, two rather sort of different personalities, but they were both going there for similar reasons. I feel closer to Joan Byers' music than I do to Iron Maiden, but, you know, chapeau to Bruce for doing that.
Ed Villiamy there, speaking to Andrew Muller, and Ed's book, When Words Fail, A Life with Music, War and Peace, is out now. This is the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
The career of the French film director Agnès Varda is a storied one, a key protagonist in the new wave of French cinema in the 1960s, where she met and befriended Chris Marker, Jean-Luc Godard and Jacques Demy, whom she married. As a filmmaker, she made films such as Le Point Court and Vagabond, changing the fabric of film itself while highlighting the work of workers. In some ways, Varda is a champion of the ordinary.
The now 90-year-old's most recent film, Faces Places, is a documentary and French road trip she made with the world-renowned photographic artist J.R. The pair of them tour, photograph, and made building-sized murals of the ordinary, perhaps forgotten people of small-town France with beautiful and poignant results. The duo were in London to promote the film this week, and Rob went to meet them.
And you know Massimo Bottura?
Yes, yeah.
So I took Agnès last night to eat.
Oh, nice.
And because he's a dear friend, I opened a restaurant with him in Paris.
And she arrived there saying, I hate any kind of fancy food, so
yeah.
I'm not that happy about it. So that's, you know, she was really like mad. And then he bring the first course, explain it to her. And, you know, I have it in video. Her eyes started going like, doo-doo-doo-doo. And then she tastes it. Like, oh my God, this is so good. Did you do that? He's like, yeah, that's what I do. And then he brought the next one. And then she went and see him.
So she's a convert, basically. This has happened.
I mean, it's not fancy with him. It's more, it's stories.
He made us try many things. Well, very little pieces. So we could do many, you know. But what I love what he said, that it doesn't use grease.
It's no oil.
Yeah. No, a little olive oil, but it doesn't put grease and butter. That makes the food be very light. I found it incredibly daring when there is, quand il y a de la sauce, he makes it with fruits and vegetables, but it's not gravy sauce that we see in so many places.
Yeah.
It's very
original.
It's very original, very original. And he loves what he does, he loves the people. That's good enough for me.
I'm getting a sense immediately from your lovely relationship from Place Village. I mean, it's such a wonderful film. Congratulations on it. Again, I know you've heard this a billion times, but I really do want to know how you meet. You mentioned that there's a date mythique in the film. How did you two meet up? Because it seems like you've known each other forever.
But it's very true what we show in the film.
Yeah.
My daughter Rosalie said to Jay, how come you never met? I said, how come? Because I knew his work, I knew books he had done, and he knew my film. But yeah, many people I never met. So Rosalie said, you should meet. So it's like in the film, he came to my house, he took pictures. And then I said, the day after, I have to give him a visit back. I went to his studio, and I took picture like this with your hat. And then the third day, he came to brought the clair au chocolat.
Oh, yeah.
He came with food.
So he's bribing
and
you.
And we said,
then I won her heart with the eclair chocolat, yes. Not with my photos.
Your skill and everything. Yeah.
And then we say, why don't we work together? And we say, maybe we could do a short. It starts like this. Let's do it together. And it's true in the film. It was friendship at first sight.
It looks like something you can't fake that, right? From both of your points of view. And there seems to be something in the film about, it's obviously about reality and it's about celebrating reality and finding, maybe celebrating the corners of the world and the corners of your country that aren't celebrated in film a lot of the time. Was that always going to be the intention of the film, that it was going to be doing that?
I don't know, but you're an artist and your pieces are all over in big cities. I say, he doesn't know the country, that guy. Let's get him. Let's use his magical truck.
Yeah.
Let's go. I was so happy to travel in the magical truck.
It's pretty good, isn't it?
Yeah, truck. That was the word I was looking for.
Yeah.
Truck. And then we saw that we could do something, which is a continuation of a big work you do, which is Inside Out, for years. Mm. So you know how to get the people in that truck. Looks like it will have a little photo. It'll come out with a poster that you invented. So, but we use it together to get the people to deal with their own image and deal with, if images can be put together, it brings the people together also.
People find that very moving, don't they? I found it very moving watching the film. It's obviously something you're used to seeing people, suddenly the image comes out and there's a moment of reckoning.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because it's like almost like, you know, magic operating, because the truck, you know, self took the photo. So it's set up and the truck does it, and then it prints it giantly on the side. It's like the size of your window. Mm-hmm. And I've done that in Japan, in the Middle East, in Brazil, and anywhere, you know, had the truck all over the world. And it's always the same. There's no, you know, border of culture. People react the same.
Yeah.
So Agnes was very excited about that. But the truth is, we really started with no plans, like she said, just a short film. And we actually started, and you'll see it at the beginning of the movie, with a little Kickstarter, you know, where you can put money online and support for our film. But there was no film. It was just like, can you help us go to our first destination? We want to go in south of France. And it's funny because people laugh at us like, wait, is there a project here? Like, and people did put the money in 2 days, but a lot of people were like, what is this? And it's true. When I think about it, we're like, damn, we actually asked people some money to start a film, but there was no film. So people thought we were going on holiday together, and it always kind of felt like that.
Please help these artists.
Yeah.
These poor artists.
But we went, and we did, and we proved that there was a journey starting there. And then producers like the MoMA or others like came and helped this movie to happen. But you'll see that the movie start with the 676 people or 71 people, that the 600 people that helped us paid for the beginning of that film.
C'était 55,000 euros.
Yeah, it was 55,000 euros.
Yeah.
But we had to give them back gifts that we had promised.
Oh, yeah. Well, you can, you know, the film itself is a
right
nice
after,
artifact.
My daughter, Rosalie, decided to say, I will do a real production. And she started to get the money from always the same Canal Plus, Arte. I mean, you have a way of producing. Mm-hmm. And then she set it up. We went for a week and we loved it. And then I said, a week is enough for me because I'm a little tired. Okay. Let's wait next month. Where do we go? We decided the place. We make contact. We go there. But the minute we arrive, the Azad proposes us things. We were always getting things by chance.
It seems, and you say this in the film, I think you say, Lazard, c'est mon meilleur assistant, right?
All my life, not even with JR, I was even before.
Yeah. Maybe this is something that both of your work shares in common. You're dealing with real people. You can't make them react in a certain way. If you cast a fictional an actor as a fictional character, then that's one thing. But both of your work, I'd say, maybe.
Yeah, and we didn't know that. I mean, we knew the work of each other, but when we met, we realized that actually we had the same process, just like you described, but also not working with brands, not accepting sponsorship. We had a lot of stuff in common. We just had a different, of course we have our own style in doing what we do, but we combine both very naturally.
Besides the fact that you don't smoke and you don't drink, which is also my case, but what happened is that we understood that we will not have Q&A with the people, but the conversation, which is very different. We were a conversation and we gave them the opportunity to see. The case I love the most, when we were dealing with the horns of the goats. Mm-hmm. And you put a big image I've done of that goat on the wall. And here's a guy, he say, what do you do? And we say, what we do. And say, oh, I didn't know that they burn the horns now. Or will I know? And then what is for me, what we succeed, is that to make them become themselves, he invents. He's not answering to us. He says, oh, they should put tennis ball and they should put something on their horns and we could paint them. So it's like, this is a success when the people is not really answering a question, but when they get themselves into the subject.
They find their own answer.
And they find their inventions of words. I think that's what is important, because it's not saying just answer, you know.
It's beautiful. And just finally, the idea of the road trip is obviously a very potent idea of discovery and all the rest of it. Was that an important part of it, being able to drive in your truck from one place to the next? You don't quite ever know what's going to be around the next bend, right?
Yes, we knew. We knew. We had the aim. We knew we wanted to go to that factory. We had been checking the place. We had the permission to do in the factory. But then what came there is that, I don't know when you had the idea, because I had a load here. J.R.
J.R.
I had allowed him to investigate about my illness. I think he was inclined to check on me, what is going bad, my legs, my eyes. So it Come became on. A game for him, and I yeah. allowed him to do it. But what I surprised was when he said, I want to take a picture of your eyes, okay, your hands, and then your toes. Okay, the toes.
Oh, the toes.
Yeah, yeah. But you saw, and you gave me the compliment. You told me they look like gnocchis. But he took the picture.
Yeah.
And the surprise was that when we were in the factory, we were there, all these trains, suddenly he put my toes on the train. I mean, do you know many people who had their toes traveling on a train?
You were very brave.
I'm unique, eh? by feet. Doesn't mean that we didn't do the job. Sociologue. I mean, c'est de l'anthropologie, you know. But we don't have to be sociologue and be serious. We can do the job and enjoy life. We enjoy filming. Because then you have the face of the sociologue and the heart, and they take notes, you know.
And we never That's my job. I'm that guy.
Yeah, yeah, and I never took notes. You never took notes. We improvise what could happen between the people and us, and together, so enjoy being together.
It seemed that's the beauty. No script, just talented people.
We got chance. We were good. But some things happened, like that Docker group that you knew. You wanted me to meet them, absolutely, and say, it's not a village, but it's vaguely a village because they're a special place. Okay. So we go there. And then I say, where are the wives? Where are the women?
Oh, yeah.
And it turned that they accepted the game, you accepted the game, and become very important because we were lucky they were on strike. So in a way, they were free to do what they wanted because in a normal time, they would never have spent so much time. Come on, appel le container, to do the container. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's incredible what they did. It allows us to do totems, you know. So I like the idea that because there was a strike, because he knew them, because I decided women should be on light, it built itself, you know. And at the end, I love when the wall is big like this and the men are down and they look at their wives and it changes vaguely their point of view because they were a little macho. And now they became aware of the beauty of representing the wife. It changes something, don't you think so?
I agree.
And we still like them, and we still see them.
That's true. A lot of them, some we knew, some we discovered, some we got to know over the years, and like we also got to know each other throughout the film, you know, and that you'll feel it in the film.
You can.
That we actually really met and then did that film, so you see us getting to know each other.
JR there with Agnès Varda speaking to Rob, and we do heartily recommend tracking down their film Visage Village, or Faces Places in English.
If you want to hear more from Agnès, do keep an eye out for a new season of The Big Interview here on Monocle 24, where we'll have an in-depth chat with the filmmaker looking back at her expansive career. That's The Big Interview, premiering next month on Monocle 24. And that, Tom, is it for edition 480 of the Monocle Weekly.
What a show, Rob. What a show that was. We met some fascinating people, old and young, all sorts of different...
It was particularly wonderful, yeah. Mark Mason, always wonderful, value, amazing. Agnès Varda and JR, formidable sort of on-screen team, and just amazing. And they were so charming together. She's 90, I believe. He's 33. He's done quite a lot for a youngish dude. But they were so fun. I hope it comes across on the chat that we played in the show there, because it's super fun, lovely dynamic between them.
And you mentioned The Big Interview, which is coming back soon, and that your big chat with Agnès will be featured on there. I think there's something particularly appealing about talking to, you know, people who've been around a bit longer, done a bit more. Yeah. And I think there's something refreshingly candid. I love that idea of people who don't worry about standing on ceremony and are a bit more forthright, because I guess when you've been around nearly a century, you kind of don't need to worry about upsetting anybody.
Yeah, indeed.
And it's something so, I don't know, it's just so easy to listen to. It's,
yeah, she's full of sort of wit and wisdom. And it's also kind of nice when a film director hasn't read the press release for their new film. Not in the kind of way of despising that whole kind of branch of communication and all the rest of it, but just kind of talks very naturally and free-flowingly in the kind of style of the person that did these wonderful films in the 60s, had a storied career since now, and has sort of updated her vision and the people that she collaborates with, such as JR and all the rest of it. So we should throw people towards The Big Interview. That's happening next month here on Monocle
2024. Let's thank our pals behind the glass. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall. Our studio managers were Cassie Galpin and George McDonough. And the Monocle Weekly will be back same time, same place next week. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bounds.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Thank you for tuning in.